Welcome back to the show, Daisy. Last month, we made the call not to record after the tragedy of what happened to Sir David Amess. Has it been a tough period for all in Parliament with this terrible event hanging over everyone?
Yeah, I think the murder of David Amess was a real shock to everybody, actually. It was a shock to the public. I think it was a shock to every MP. I think, obviously, those MPs that knew him for a long time, the ones who were most, you know, most severely affected, because obviously they didn't just lose a colleague, they lost a real friend. And he had been an MP for a very long time. And I think a lot of those MPs who had been in Parliament for a long time knew him very well. And it's clear that, you know, many of them are still grieving. So, yeah, I think it's been really tough for a lot of people.
And what are your own memories of Sir David?
Well, to be honest, I didn't really know him very well at all. You know, I was elected in 2019 and I was only 3 months into the job when we went into the pandemic and we went onto a virtual parliament effectively. So I'd only passed him in the corridor a couple of times. We'd been on a few Zoom calls together. There was one occasion where I remember, you know, I said something a little bit rude about the government in terms of how they were handling the cladding and fire safety scandal. And he and I were on the same side of the argument on this issue. And I said something a little bit rude and he did a massive, massive belly laugh. But of course, because it was on Zoom, he was muted. And so I could see him rocking in his chair laughing, but I couldn't hear anything. And I do remember just thinking, gosh, I really wish we'd been in a physical room so I could have heard that, because it looks like it would have been very funny.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I mean, I didn't know him at all well. I can't pretend that I did. But it's clear that a lot of people did know him very well and they were incredibly fond of him. And I think a lot of the tributes that came out after his murder, you know, showed just sort of what a naughty sense of humour he had. And I think people, you know, a lot of people said they'll really miss him.
And going forward, Daisy, obviously this has affected his family and his friends. And we at Radio Verulam, you know, send out our condolences. It's a really tragic time. But there is more questions now than ever about the protection of MPs. What do you believe needs to be done to avoid something similar occurring whilst keeping what is one of the amazing, unique facets of the British parliamentary system, your closeness with your constituents?
Yeah, it's a good question. I don't think anybody's fully got the answer yet. So there is a sort of there's a comprehensive review of the security of MPs that's taking place behind the scenes, and you know, when that concludes, I'm sure there'll be some recommendations from it. I think the first thing to say is that there are already a lot of measures that MPs take. So you know, we have personal alarms. I think some MPs you know, have these what they call open surgeries, so they just advertise where they're going to be and anybody can walk in. Other MPs tend to do them by appointment only, and that helps you to, you know, check people against the electoral register to make sure they are who they are, you know, who they say they are. I mean, clearly there are issues, you know, as an MP, you agree to go to events and sometimes people want to be able to advertise that in advance. And therefore, you know, anybody who wished you ill would be able to see where you are. And there are questions around security in those kind of instances. But generally speaking, I would say, you know, there are quite a lot of measures in place already. You know, we are offered different types of security measures depending on different levels of threats to individual MPs. And it's very different in different areas. You know, I think, you know, for an MP that lives in an area where, for example, there's a, you know, very high level of, I don't know, say knife crime or something, they might want to have extra measures related to that. But other MPs, you know, who live in a constituency that's hundreds of miles, you know, from north to south, east to west, full of little villages, I mean, the idea that you can have an armed guard with you is kind of crazy. So I think we have to be, you know, we have to be realistic about this. We have to be proportionate. You can never eliminate all risk. But I just think that for those security measures that are already offered to us as MPs, I'm just hoping that most MPs will, if they haven't already taken them up, that they will do.
And you personally, Daisy, have you ever felt unsafe or threatened whilst you've been working?
I probably shouldn't really go into any kind of sort of specifics. All I can say is that, you know, if I've ever been concerned, you know, we make, you know, the appropriate reports and things. And by and large, you know, St Albans is my home. You know, I know a lot of people come up to me and I want people to be able to come up to me and ask me questions or, you know, and raise issues with me so I can help them out if needed, or just give them my point of view on something. So, you know, by and large, I say St Albans is my home. My friends and neighbours are here, as well as knowing people as sort of constituents, which is, I always find, a very peculiar word. So I, you know, I go about town and go around the villages. You know, I cycle around about on my own. You know, I feel very, very safe.
Well, that's good to hear. And, you know, BIM and BAMBOS also reflected something, and hopefully there is cross-party agreement on a good idea or something to protect the future of the democracy of this country as well, because that is an attack on democracy. But let's talk about one of the biggest talking points over the last month. It's been the second job scandal, the debate over whether MPs should have second jobs at all. Daisy, first and foremost, have you ever been paid for a second job whilst being an MP?
No. I think I was given 100 quid from The Guardian for writing a piece about what it was like to be a new MP. And from recollection, I think I gave that to charity. But no, apart from that, no, I haven't.
So on that issue then, do you believe that it's right that MPs should be allowed second jobs, even though their earnings are way above the average of the country?
Do you know what? I think there needs to be, I do genuinely think there needs to be reform, and Liberal Democrats have voted for a reform of the current system. I think it's important that somebody looks at this issue in detail. And I mean, generally on the whole, you know, I find my job to be all consuming and it takes so many hours. You know, I don't have any intention. I never have had any intention of having a second job. But I have heard examples from other people where they've tried to explain why it's been necessary. And I think we need to make sure that if we are going to ban all second jobs, that it doesn't limit the diversity of people that can come into politics. So, for example, there's a woman who used to be an MP that isn't an MP anymore. And she gave an example of, you know, when she was elected, she soon became a single mum after she was elected. Now, of course, as an MP, if you don't live in the centre of London, if you live anywhere else, you know, if you live a long way from London, you have to travel into London on a Monday morning. You don't go home until a Thursday night. And therefore, she had to very quickly put one of her young child into a private school because she didn't have any other sort of you know, family structures to help her. And so there's a genuine question, I think, of given the nature of the job as being a parliamentarian, where you can be away from home for, you know, 4 days a week. And these days, if you're pinged, you know, you might be away from home for 2 or 3 weeks. Is it realistic to get a diversity of people into politics given those pressures? So I think on the whole, I recognise that MPs and, you know, our salaries put us in the top 5% of earners in the country. You know, I don't think it's a case of MPs needing more money necessarily. It's just that, you know, are there issues with the nature of the job? I don't know. So generally speaking, there has to be reform. I think ideally people wouldn't have second jobs. But if there are examples where people where Parliament as a whole is going to lose out on the diversity of people, we just need to be mindful of that. And that's why I think we shouldn't just sort of necessarily rush into it. I do think there needs to be a group of people that look at this to make sure that we're not excluding some people from the chance to actually stand for election. So that's the kind of, that's the way I would come at it.
No, it's a fascinating insight, maybe adding a bit of nuance to the argument. And I was just going to say as well, for you, in effect...
Sorry, to just add to that as well, it may be that actually you say definitely no jobs, but to get a greater diversity, you put other measures in place instead. I think that's the key.
Yeah, no, I get that. And that's kind of adding to the argument there. And I was just going to say quickly, in effect, you do have more than one job, though, because you are deputy leader of your party as well. And I'm sure that takes up a lot of time. You know, people who are have multiple jobs within parties, you know, maybe party whips and things like that. But maybe linked to this issue, kind of talking there of making Parliament as open as possible, let's bring it to the fact that it's been 103 years since Parliament allowed women to stand as MPs. Since then, 5,000 MPs have been elected, but only 556 have been women. Even now, Parliament, I'm sure you well know, Daisy, is less than 40% women. What do you believe needs to be done for greater gender equality?
Oh gosh, there's so much. There's still such a long way to go, I think, to get gender equality. I mean, the first thing that I would say, and you might expect me to say this as a Lib Dem, is that I would like to see a change of our voting system, because there's a lot of evidence that shows that our current voting system, which is first past the post, is a very confrontational one. You know, in order to try and beat somebody, you have to explain why you're completely different to them, and you have to tell everybody else that their vote is wasted. And those are kind of the structures that first past the post creates, and therefore it becomes a very confrontational kind of politics. Whereas if you move to a fairer form of voting, it's more collaborative and you're trying to encourage people, you're trying to explain why your views and your values are closer to the person that somebody wants to vote for. So it really changes the nature of politics. And there is evidence that suggests that, you know, people generally, but especially women, are put off politics when it's confrontational. So that's one thing. The second thing is that Parliament is really, you know, it is still very out of date, I think, in many respects. And we saw this week, you know, Stella Creasy took her baby into a debate. I actually walked into that room in that debate because I had a debate shortly after after the one that she was in. So I walked into the room and Stella was there with her baby, and, you know, she left it before my debate started. And he was fast asleep. You know, he was fast asleep. He was good as gold. He didn't know what was going on. And even if he'd woken up and had a little snuffle, you know, like some babies do, it wouldn't have been disruptive. And I think most workplaces are very accommodating of these kind of things these days. And Parliament does just need to, you know, move into the 21st century on some of this stuff.
I mean, some would argue that the baby might have a more legitimate point of view than some of the parliamentarians. He might speak a bit more sense. But with that situation then, yeah, the Stella Creasy incident, I think, highlights this distance that needs to be done for women politicians. One thing that has been raised, BIM was obviously against it, Bambos was kind of for it because it's a Labour Party idea, but all women shortlists, what do you think are on that kind of situation? Does that improve the chances of women being involved with politics in a fair way?
Yeah, do you know, I went on a bit of a journey with this because a few years ago I was really against the women shortlists. And there was a group of people within the Lib Dems who were trying to persuade me to support it. And so I set them the challenge of trying to persuade me to change my mind. And they bombarded me with evidence and research papers from all sorts of universities. And I very reluctantly, you know, found that actually I did change my mind. And I, you know, and so I've now come around to being a big supporter of all women shortlists. I think what's frustrating for me is the biggest attack line against all women shortlists is that, you know, we have to use them because you believe women can't make it on their own merit. That's not correct. Like, that's not the purpose of all women shortlists. You have to look at it through the other lens, which is that if you want a group of people to be making good decisions, we know from evidence and research that you get better decisions if you have more diversity in the room. That's diversity in terms of gender, in terms of ethnicity, in terms of socioeconomic background, in terms of personality types, neurodiversity, all these different things. The greater diversity you have in a room, the better decisions you will take because you're more representative of the public as a whole. And therefore, if there are fewer women proportionally in the room, then you'll be making worse decisions. So it isn't about whether an individual woman can make it on her own or not. It's a case of whether collectively as a group, the people you are electing can make the best decisions. And so because there's so much unconscious bias in society, I think that all women shortlists are a good thing, and they've been proven to work as well. I think personally, I would like to see all LGBT plus shortlists and all ethnic minority shortlists introduced in law as well. I know that BIM is against those as well, but that's, you know, that's his point of view. He's entitled to that. For me, it is not about whether any of these individuals from with different protected characteristics can make it or not. There are already different tests in place for that. So if you want to become a candidate in any political party, you have to apply to and you have to pass a test, right? And if you pass your assessment day, then the party thinks you're good enough. So that automatically says you're good enough. The second question then is, collectively as a group, do we have enough diversity in that group to make good decisions? And that's why you end up using these shortlists. So I think people look at it from the wrong end of the spectrum.
And just quickly on that, do you remember any of the maybe articles or authors of the articles that you'd suggest people to maybe read on this issue?
Do you know what? I really can't. It was quite a long time ago. We had the debate in the Lib Dems on this issue. I think it was in 2016. Yeah. But I was so persuaded that I actually ended up leading the campaign for the all use of all women shortlists and other things. So it was around 2015, 2016. But there were articles from various universities in Spain. And I think from, is it MIB in America as well? MIT, sorry. I can't remember any of them now, but it was quite a few years ago.
I mean, one that just comes to my head is Professor Sarah Childs. From RHUL. So just if people are interested on that issue, then please do read about it a little bit more. So let's maybe push it on to a congratulations are in order for you, because you've been made the Liberal Democrats health and social care spokesperson. I mean, what does this extra role entail?
Well, first of all, I wouldn't really call it an extra role. We've had a bit of a mini reshuffle. So I'm no longer the education spokesperson. I'm the health and care spokesperson instead. I mean, fundamentally, what it means is that I'm the lead spokesperson for my party on health and social care issues. So when health and social care issues are being debated in Parliament or they're being debated in the media, then I'm the person who will normally, first and foremost, be the one to speak on behalf of my party, the Lib Dems. So that's really what it's about. And since I took up that role a few weeks ago, it's been a very, very busy role over the last few weeks. So, for example, I've managed to highlight the problem with booster jabs, where, you know, people in St Albans were contacting me saying, I'm eligible for my booster jab. I want to get my booster jab. I'm trying to book my booster jab, but I can't get it because I haven't had a letter yet. So I raised that in Parliament and they fixed the system as a result. There's been a real lots of confusion around the third primary dose for people who are clinically extremely vulnerable. The big issue this week for me has been the pressure on ambulances. And I recently, just in the last few days, actually exposed the fact that every ambulance service in the whole of England is now at its highest alert level. So I've been pushing the government to introduce measures to try and support our ambulance service, which is, you know, massively overstretched.
Well, also part of this role has meant that you've been front line of the social care reform. This bill seemingly means that the Conservatives have gone against their manifesto pledge of nobody needing care should be forced to pay their sell their homes to pay for it. What would the Liberal Democrats do differently?
Well, first of all, let me talk about the bill. I mean, the bill to me feels like it's really back to front. So it's called the Health and Social Care Bill, but actually it's about reforms to the NHS. There aren't any real structural reforms to social care at all. And the government is supposed to be bringing forward, a white paper at some point soon, which will set out some options on how to reform social care. It's putting the cart before the horse, put it that way, right? There's a bill that's legislating on health and social care, but we haven't seen what reforms the government's going to bring forward on social care. So that's one of the major problems with the bill. As you say, there has been this proposal to shift the goalposts. So the government had introduced a proposal about how to pay for social care costs. And broadly speaking, it was following a model that came from an independent inquiry that had cross-party support. And it was saying that to pay for your social care costs, there should be a cap and a floor. You know, there should be a certain, you shouldn't have to pay beyond a certain amount. This proposal has been on the table for months and months and months. It's been through months of scrutiny by cross-party committees. And then at the very last hour, during one of the debates around sleaze, the government snuck out this change and suddenly said, actually, people who have fewer resources are going to have to suddenly pay a lot more for their social care costs. And that means that people who are the ones who are really struggling, the ones with the lowest incomes and the lowest wealth, are going to be the ones that have to pay more for social care costs. And that's deeply unfair. So in terms of what we would do differently as Liberal Democrats, well, there's two or three things we said at the last election, and we'll put proposals forward ahead of the next general election. But at the last general election, what we said we would do is that we would create an immediate cash injection into our NHS and social care services by increasing, by having a, you know, 1p in the tax, 1p in the pound increase in income tax, which is a fairer tax than using national insurance. Then we said we would set up a cross-party group to look at other ideas for a longer-term sustainable funding solution. And one of those solutions could, for example, be a ring-fence health and social care tax. So I think the proposals from the Deal Not Review about having a cap and a floor are kind of good in principle. We probably would have followed that recommendation, but we would have liked to have made it more generous for those on the lowest incomes. I think what we've seen this week from the Conservatives is, you know, at the 11th hour, without any warning, after months and months and months, they've suddenly changed, you know, they've moved the goalposts and made it harder for those at the bottom of the ladder.
And does that make it harder for you as well in Parliament? Are you going to be able to kind of put your views across it and maybe protest or change this legislation?
Well, I mean, I think there's been a lot of opposition from opposition parties, but there's also been a lot of opposition from within the government's own ranks as well. The bill is now going to go into what's called a stage of ping pong. So MPs in the House of Commons have two or three attempts to look at legislation. You have the first reading, the second reading, the third reading, and a committee stage. And so there's a lot of scrutiny of a piece of legislation. Then it goes to the House of Lords. And then comes back to the House of Commons and it goes a ping pong between the two different houses. And that's the stage at which members of the House of Lords can make recommendations to try and change things in the legislation. So because it was a very close vote and there were a lot of Conservative MPs that either didn't vote for, either they voted against the government's proposal or they abstained and refused to vote at all to register their unhappiness and unease, I think the government should listen to those concerns and it should think again. And I think this process of ping pong will definitely help with that. So Liberal Democrats in the House of Commons and the House of Lords will be working hard to try and change it.
Let's move it to the community questions then. And as always, people can message in before you come on, Daisy, and ask for things to be answered. Ryan has asked the question, I keep seeing lots of proposals and plans for new housing, but how can we keep making new homes without adding more infrastructure to our area? He believes that schools, hospitals and all our local services are already overstretched. Shouldn't they be improved first?
Yeah, it's a great question, and it's one that I get quite a lot. So, I mean, the fact is that the government has set these top-down targets, and it says that St Albans has got to build more than 14,600 homes over the next 15 years. And so we are going to have to see a lot more development. And if the local council can't identify enough sites to build all these houses, then our planning powers are taken away and the planning inspector will then decide where to build. So it's really important that we get this plan put down. Where an entirely new site is identified and where there are proposals for, you know, several hundred or several thousand new homes, on those really big sites, then they are required to introduce plans for infrastructure. And there are things that the local district council can do in terms of putting conditions down about which bits have to be built first. So, you know, a district council might say, well, the access road has to be built first before you can build any houses, or you have to build the school before, you know, once you've built, I don't know, 30% of the homes, you have to build the school before you can keep building other homes or something like that. So there are powers that exist for that. I think one of the problems we've had in St Albans was a change in the law that was made by Eric Pickles, who was the Conservative minister at the time. And he said that when you have big blocks of flats, the owners of those big blocks, when you have big blocks of, off, when you have big office blocks, he changed the law to say that a big office block could be converted into flats without anyone needing to apply for a change of use. And what that has meant is that lots of blocks of offices in St Albans have been turned into flats, but there hasn't been any requirement in law for the new infrastructure to come with it. And that's the major problem that I think we've had in our area. So we did have all these kind of office blocks. You get them in, you know, Victoria Street and along London Road and Ridgemont Road and all around there. Many of those places, those office blocks have been converted into flats, but no infrastructure has come because that change in the law wasn't written properly, basically. So I completely accept that it's produced a bit of gridlock in the centre of the city, and Liberal Democrats were opposed to that change at the time. The issue we have now is the new sites that are going to come online, come on stream over the next few years. And those new sites will have a requirement for infrastructure, and we'll have to make sure that we get that right.
Let's move it to Ian's question. And this one is very hot, very still in the discussions because we don't know everything that's happened. But he has said he is disgusted that we have seen more people being made to suffer and now die due to the government's callous attitude towards refugees. Do you think the tragedy of the death of people crossing over to the UK will spark a change in approach, Daisy?
Oh, well, I really hope it does. I mean, I don't know whether it will, but I really hope it does, because it's just tragic. I don't know about you, but I've cried about this at least two or three times in the last few days. I found it really, really, really upsetting. You know, if I just think on a very selfish basis, I think back to times in my life where I felt incredibly scared, and I try and imagine what it must be like to feel that sense of being really, really scared, but being in the water, in the dark, in the cold, on your own, hearing other people's voices disappear because they're drowning and knowing that no one is coming to save you and having come to that slow realization that you're going to die alone in the cold water. I just can't even imagine just how awful that really, really is. And just thinking about it has, you know, brought me to tears several times in the last few days. In terms of the system, you know, the vast majority of people who are coming over here on the Channel, they are asylum seekers. They are people fleeing war and famine and other situations like that. And we know this because the government's own figures say so. So the government's own figures say that 98% of the people who come on these Channel crossings apply for asylum. They apply to become refugees. So they apply for asylum, and less than 10% of those applications fail in the courts. And therefore, we know from the government's own figures that they are mostly asylum seekers. And, you know, we heard that, you know, we think that there was an Afghan interpreter, you know, who died the other day. So we need to separate out the use of words like asylum seeker from migrants. And in terms of what needs to be done, what I've been saying and what Liberal Democrats have been saying for years and years and years is we need to have safe and legal routes so that people can apply from anywhere in the world to come to this country. And the problem we have is that this Conservative government has closed down lots of those different routes. You know, there's a route for, you know, the new safe and legal route for 20,000 Afghan refugees hasn't even been opened. The Dubs scheme, named after Lord Dubs, who was a refugee who came to this country, he, you know, we were supposed to be accepting 3,000 unaccompanied children every year, and that has effectively been closed down. There were three other resettlement programs that got combined into one and massively reduced the number of people that could come here. And so if the government could set up safe and legal routes for people to apply for asylum, then they wouldn't have to resort to trying to cross on the channel. It wouldn't eliminate the problem altogether, but it would massively reduce it. And that's something the government could do. It's within their power to do it. And I just wish they would get on with it.
Tina has moved the question on to maybe your personal situation. She's asked, it was World Mental Health Day. As someone who has a stressful job, Daisy, and criticism from the public, how do you stay in charge of your mental health? Do you have any tips?
Ah, well, do you know what? I believe in doing some of the basics. So I do believe in getting a good amount of sleep. I don't always get enough sleep that I need. I don't always get all the sleep that I need, but I do try and make up for it every now and then. Sleep is enormously powerful. And I think people who boast about not needing to sleep I think doing themselves a disservice. You know, we know that sleep is incredibly powerful as a sort of physical healer, but also in terms of, you know, helping your emotional resilience as well. Eating well, that's something else I believe in. And I'm very lucky that my husband sends me into Parliament with my pet lunch most days. So I have a nice nutritious meal for lunchtime. And that's also really good. Doing exercise, I think, is important. You know, I probably don't do enough of that. And then I guess sometimes, you know, you have to look after yourself, don't you? But I mean, let's remember that, you know, mental health is a huge catch-all term, and it can refer to some people who are just suffering with, you know, a bit of, you know, people who are feeling a bit stressed and depressed.
Yeah.
And it ranges from that at one end to people at the other who are clinically depressed and suffering perhaps, you know, bouts of psychosis. And actually there's a difference between people who are dealing with their day-to-day well-being, and those are really the kind of things that I'm talking about in terms of, you know, sleeping and eating and, you know, seeing your friends and nurturing yourself. There's a big distinction between that and the more clinical side of mental ill health, where quite frankly, you know, you could do all of those things, but, you know, mental ill health can be a disease that really kind of grips people, and doesn't matter how many hours you sleep or what you eat, you know, it can still you know, reappear. So for those cases, you know, people have to, you know, they have to do what's right for them, and they have to follow the medical advice they're being given. And I will continue to campaign for more resources for our mental health services, because, you know, we know that it's one of the big issues arising from the pandemic. So yeah, I can probably give tips on well-being, but sort of less so on the kind of clinical mental health side.
And the final question this month is from Nick. He said, what is the best and worst thing about being an MP?
Best and the worst. So I say the worst thing probably is just that there is a huge volume. There's a huge volume of emails, you know, some from residents, but also a lot from other places as well. There's all sorts of lobby groups that want to meet with you all the time. And, you know, a lot of them you have to just say no to. So there's a huge volume of stuff that comes in towards you as an MP. And you just have to spend a lot of time filtering things and deleting things and saying no to, you know, all these other kind of random things. So that's it's a volume of stuff, I think, is one bit I struggle with. The best bit, honestly, is being able to help individual people and to help fix their problems. And sometimes in the most extreme cases, you know, help people, enable them to turn their lives around. That's probably one of the most rewarding bits, I would say.
Fascinating insight, and I think a nice way to end this month's discussion. You'll be back again next month, Daisy, to answer questions. We'll be looking at the year in review as well, because it will be December, and we can have a look back at the 12 months previous. But as always, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.